Welcome to the Flat Chat Podcast. Welcome indeed to the club. There's a new issue of GP Racing magazine on the shelves, and what a cover. In this month's issue, we welcome Max Verstappen to the exclusive club of Formula One's multiple champions, and we see how he compares with them. So, here's a trigger warning for listeners with partisan views about certain drivers. Less easily triggered are our guests. Time to say g'day, Cobber, to hopefully in a flame-proofed abode, Mark Gallagher in Australia.
Yeah, I think at the moment it's less about being flame-proof and more about being waterproof, because the northeast of the country has had the worst ever floods. I mean, just incredible images coming through from Queensland of entire airports under floodwater. When we hear we've got, 25 millimetres of rain due in the next week or something in England, just think about the fact that in one place in Queensland this weekend, there was 2 metres of water fell out of the sky in a day. Just incredible stuff. So down here in Adelaide, South Australia, very pleased to say, it's just a little bit windy, quite warm and quite sunny. So not too bad, and no fires. So we're in that nice in between catastrophe stage.
Joining us from hopefully sunny Stamford or thereabouts is Matt Q.
I won't complain about the mizzle now that Mark has teed us up with that. I just feel downright insensitive, but it's a grey and bleak day. I can't see a patch of open sky anywhere, I don't think. Just blanket sort of tedious greyness, which hopefully this podcast will not be.
We aspire to a little bit of colour, don't we? Hopefully not too much. Let's see if we can get through this whole thing without a trigger warning, because yes, as soon as you start comparing one driver with another, that sort of sets the antennae of people, especially the denizens of X, formerly known as Twitter, of course, on edge. We know that Max doesn't compare himself with other drivers because he says so, right? Yes. And yet in Abu Dhabi, he was obviously desperate to ensure he set a new record for laps led in a season, going over 1,000. So maybe he does like to know where he stands in comparison with everyone else. So Alex Kalinauskas had the tricky task of looking at all the common features Max shares with the greatest drivers of all time, some of whom are represented on the cover, some of whom aren't, because there wasn't enough room. We weren't making too many choices. Now, when this feature was being discussed, when it feels like a long time ago now, the Austin Grand Prix, Circuit of the Americas, lovely warm sunshine, you, me and Alex sat outside and we divvied up responsibilities for the various features, and you were handed the one that will be on the newsstands next month. Alex was given the one that went on the newsstands this month. So now you can tell us how good a job you thought he did.
Excellent. Yeah, Alex has been sort of toying with this idea for a while and sort of going back and forth with questions and teeing them up in different press conferences and interviews to put together a really sort of, comprehensive package. And it is difficult. As you say, Max really tries to avoid comparing himself to other drivers. That's not to say he doesn't think of it. Maybe he doesn't, but certainly he's wise enough not to fall into the pitfalls of sort of engaging in this stuff in the media and pushing, putting people's noses out of joints by besmirching the reputation of Senna or Schumacher or whoever. But that's his agenda in public. We know that what he presents in public and what he actually thinks are very different things. Look at, from this season, look at Miami or Japan, where, he said, obviously he had the setbacks, Perez won in Azerbaijan. Red Bull had their worst weekend of the year in Singapore. When they have a setback like that, Max Verstappen feels more than the need to come back. He almost likes to humiliate his rivals with just how dominant he was against Perez in Miami. How sort of unimpeachable he was in Suzuka. That's the way he likes to come back. And you can ask him about that even 6-7 races down the line. And he doesn't engage. He doesn't say that, this was like a concerted effort to make them feel this big sort of thing. That simulating how big they feel in a podcast format with my fingers doesn't work very well, but making them feel this big. So he doesn't engage in that. But, I think we can make an educated guess that those are his intentions or those are how he feels. So he doesn't compare himself. He's not going to take on Alan Prost or whoever in public. But as you said, when he was very deliberately targeting plus 1,000 laps to sort of underline, double underscore, embolden his achievements this season. He knew, again, that was very much a target for him. So he sort of, his like party line moves throughout the year, whether he does or doesn't engage with achievements and where he stands among the best or whatever. But yeah, Alex, really good, great job of dissecting, you know, his weight, his racecraft, his intellect, you know, even potentially his legacy. And sorry, just to, so, and to go back to where I started, if you like, when he doesn't engage in that, what Alex has done is a great job of speaking of people who have worked across different areas, you know, speaking to Andrea Steller or Xavi Pujolal, whoever, to, you know, because if Max won't engage in those comparisons directly, then those people will, or certainly have the experience to sort of pull together several different areas to help compile what is a superb cover feature. And like you say, hat tip to Frank Foster for another fabulous bit of cover art.
Yes, when Frank said, "I've got an idea," I thought, good, because mine was terrible. The idea I put forward for the cover was very much out of the bottom drawer. And so, yeah, when I think Frank has a thing about country club sort of things, because he always used to say he imagines my cats in tweeds, because of course the whole house revolves around them. So he sort of imagines them sitting around in tweeds, sort of giving commandments. So he's been waiting for an excuse to whack some drivers in tweeds for quite some time and put them in a country club format. And yeah, it's been interesting, the response of people on X, formerly known as Twitter. It's actually been interesting. It hasn't been the massive torrent of fury you expect in that format, but lots of people looking in very great detail, you know, the tattoos that we paid some poor soul to Photoshop onto Lewis's double's hands, all that sort of thing. People commenting about what side the coats are buttoned. The image must have been reversed. You know, I mean, we're not pretending we actually dressed Max Verstappen and Lewis Hamilton up in tweeds and took them to a country club. Can you imagine? It's quite funny. Well, anyway, just wait till you see what we've got on the next cover.
Can I just say, I make that. Is that the fourth mahogany photo frame to appear on a cover of GP Racing this year to go with the Mercedes Banksy effort?
I have to say, I think the cover is stunning. Yeah, very arresting. I mean, when I saw it come through, I really did do a double take. For 1 second, I suddenly thought, have you somehow managed to get Lewis and Max and Red Bull and Mercedes to agree? And then, of course, I realized in the same thought almost that would be impossible. But it's a very striking image. I love it. Great job, Frank. And the piece is great, because, I mean, what a thorny subject. You know, when you start comparing drivers, first of all, drivers of the current generation, never mind drivers with previous generations, because it's just fraught. But of course, as Alex says in the piece itself, it is something we all love doing. You know, everyone loves doing a compare and contrast. You know, it's for so long it was who's going to be the next Senna. You know, that was kind of talked about in the paddock for a couple of decades. And of course, now we have the Max and Lewis thing, and there's Fernando there and Sebastian Vettel. But I think what's interesting about this is just to, if you read it in the way that I'm sure Alex is meant to be read, which is you take a step back and you look at where Max fits in terms of the flow of Formula One since it was created in 1950, and the drivers who've made it, the drivers who haven't, the drivers who should have and for whatever reason didn't. You know, let's be clear, there was a time when drivers, frankly, didn't survive long enough. And that comes up a couple of times in the article where, you know, drivers like Ascari or, you know, Jim Clark just weren't able to survive the sport. And that's one of the reasons why, from my own personal perspective, it's utterly pointless to be doing the greatest of all time, you know, discussion or having that discussion, because everything has changed. The technology's changed, the sport has changed, the safety has changed, the reliability has changed. Last night I was chatting online with an Air Force pilot, and he was saying, oh, it's 120 years since the Wright brothers first flew a plane. And he said, like, who's the better pilot, the Wright brothers or me? And I said, well, surely you, because you're a mate of mine. But he said, you know, like, really everything has changed. But arguably the complexity with what pilots have to deal with today is, you know, phenomenal. So again, with Formula One drivers, there's a has to be a realization that possibly the best you can do is to compare era in terms of technical rules and regulations, era in terms of the drivers themselves, how they've prepared, how they have to prepare for the sport, the athleticism required, so on and so forth. I love the couple of paragraphs in the middle about the fact that Max's father, Jos, had been teammate to Michael Schumacher, of course, at Benetton, and how the families had become friends and spent time together. And I love that thought of a young Max Verstappen on a vacation somewhere with, you know, Michael Schumacher when he was in his pomp. And just in those paragraphs in the feature to then talk about the similarities in terms of driving styles, the way they, you know, both Michael and Max love to attack a corner. You know, the car has to rotate quite quickly into the corner. And also the unforgiving nature of their driving, to the point where they're both known for their aggression and sometimes stepping over the limit of what's acceptable. But as Alex quite rightly points out, Max has never done it to the level that Michael did. But there is something there, isn't there, around nurture. You know, when a driver is being nurtured, you know, Max by his father, and Max by his father, he would have looked and been influenced by what Michael did. And there is this huge aggression that is in there. But I think what's for me interesting is then having watched how Max has developed just as a human being, from being this kid who came into Formula One with Toro Rosso as a teenager, through to the man that he now is, and this multiple champion, and the confidence that has grown with him, and also what a completely different personality he is from Lewis Hamilton or from Fernando Alonso. What interests him, what doesn't interest him. And as you say, you know, Matt, the fact that depending on kind of when you talk to Max and what you talk to him about, he is kind of at times aware of where he stands within the pantheon of Formula One, and other times it's of no interest to him at all, because he just wants to win the next race and get another victory under his belt. But when I got to the end of this feature, the thing that really struck home to me is this feature has been written and we're reading it at a time when Max is potentially still only midway through his career. And, you know, what is there still to come? It's just going to be fascinating to see. I for one, really hope that he doesn't get bored with it and hang up his helmet too early. I hope he somehow finds what Lewis has found in terms of the motivation to just keep digging and keep going, because I think, you know, that's something that Lewis is just incredible for at the age of, I mean, was he about to turn 39 and he still got it. And, you know, will Max still have that in well over a decade's time?
Well, a few years ago, probably about 20 actually, Tom Clarkson, the F1 press conference host, also does podcast for F1, back then was part of the F1 Racing, as the magazine was known then, feature writing setup. And he did an off-season feature where he rode from Land's End to John O'Groats. It might actually have been the other way around. He might have gone from John O'Groats to Land's End with of the sort of a rotating cast of F1 people. So Mark Webber joined him and Damon Hill joined him. The then recently retired Damon Hill joined him for a bit. And Damon said to Tom, and Tom relayed this to me, and I thought this is a very important piece of racing driver psychology. Damon said to him at the end of the ride, you know, enjoy the moment of this success of having got there and achieved your goal, because when you wake up the next morning, it'll be in the past and you've got the next, you have to set a goal. You need to fill your time somehow. And I suppose that is the gap where you wonder, at what point does Max Verstappen decide, well, actually I've won enough world championships, and decides to step back. I suppose it depends on the fabric of the competition, doesn't it? Like if you remember right at the dog end of Fernando Alonso's time with McLaren, and they were sort of scrapping to get even into the top 10, and Fernando's race engineer said to him as he was in 11th place in Abu Dhabi or something, come on, Fernando, there's a world championship point on the table here. And Alonso said, I already have 900 and whatever, and just, you know, don't even bug me about this insignificant point. Now here he is 3 or 4 years later, absolutely fighting like a dog for every single point he can get again. So the worm can turn. They can sometimes decide they can't be bothered, and then pivot on a sixpence. Not that I've ever seen a sixpence, because I was born in the year of decimalization.
Well, if I can just pick you up on that point, because I think I've mentioned it a couple of times. Certainly, we have discussed it before on podcasts. The best thing that ever happened to Fernando Alonso was leaving F1 and having a breather and rediscovering what it was that he enjoyed about it. And he's come back, you know, completely rejuvenated. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Damon Hill in relation to that story that Tom Clarkson shared, because I think most people will agree, you know, the end of Damon's career in Formula One was disappointing. He was with, you know, my team at Jordan, and quite frankly, that second half of the 99 season was, he should have retired, he should have stopped, he didn't want to be there anymore, and the excitement had gone. And I often wonder if Damon had taken a break, and actually it struck me over the years how many drivers should take a break, because they may discover that they miss it hugely, and they rediscover what it was about the sport that made them fall in love with it in the first instance. But as you say, with Fernando now, of course, you know, he's fighting tooth and nail for every point in a way that perhaps, you know, he wasn't doing, you know, just before he took his sort of sabbatical from Formula One. So it's the whole driver psychology thing is interesting. And again, Damon's point to Tom was so right, that the competitive people really, each time they tick off an achievement, then they just want to go on to the next one. They're not interested in what happened last weekend, last month, last year. They just want to know, can I win the next one? Can I keep going? How do I sustain this performance? And I think Max has definitely got that hunger. You know, watching him this year, the way he just, at no point got to the stage of, oh, you know, I don't need to keep pushing. I mean, he was so on top of the car. And I mean, again, in the feature, you know, Alex talks about Adrian Newey's view of Max, that he's got so much in store, you know, he's got so much mental capacity. He's just at one with the car, and he knows how to get the most out of it. And he also knows he doesn't need to drive the car absolutely flat out, not by a long way, on a number of occasions this year. He's sort of, everything's very controlled and within himself. I mean, it must be such a joyful experience to be that much in control of your success. And, you know, not many drivers have had that. And Max is definitely right up there, one of the ones who's, you know, found that magic. And we're in the middle of watching it.
You do get it in other disciplines as well. I think sort of Michael Phelps is perhaps the most famous case, sort of guy who's most vocal about it, but even like other within motorsport, Antonio Felix da Costa is a driver I've spoken to about it. But, you know, essentially you're plucked into a car at the age of 4 and you're trained, conditioned, you hit the gym, you have your diet all to achieve this success, being the world champion of whatever discipline, whether it is swimming or electric competition. That is, you know, to coin a phrase from Hamilton, that becomes your North Star, and you do it. And then And also, anyone who's watched a fantastic Braun GP documentary on Disney Plus will appreciate this as well, because Button talks about it. But you then get to the party dies down eventually. You get back to your hotel room. You're on your own. It sinks in. And you wake up the next day, and besides a sore head, you can feel incredibly flat because you have achieved everything you have worked towards. And then it's a bit like waking up and going, blimey, what's my purpose again? What do I do now? And obviously Phelps, whoever, they come back and go on and win medal after medal after medal. But it's that first sort of gym session back in January where it's cold and wet and you're wondering why you're sacrificing so much as all your, you know, mates are doing whatever on Instagram. I don't know, but that sort of psychological leap. And that's not to say Verstappen doesn't go through that, but he never, ever gives a hint. And I you know, it's preferences. I think I find when I dealt in Formula E, Antonio Felix da Costa, I found him to be incredibly human and all the better for it. But Verstappen is, you know, it's a horrible cliche, but he's so like metronomically reliable, isn't he? The way he goes about things, and you just never get the sense that that sort of enters his psyche. But then again, maybe you see the flip side to that, which is he is never ever committed to having a long career. He's always alluded to his current Red Bull contract being his last and him being unhappy with the direction the 2026 rules are going and the addition of sprint races and why that might force him to sort of cool time on his career. So maybe he doesn't have that slump the day after the success, and maybe that means he will go on a run of title after title after title if Red Bull give him the tools to do so. But then he will just like that decide that, blimey, I am exhausted, and he will go and pursue other things at that point rather than having the annual sort of, oh, bloody hell, let's do this again.
On point of order, Michael Phelps, a swimmer, if he doesn't like things being cold and wet, he's in the wrong trade, isn't he?
Quite.
Interestingly, on a slightly tangential thought, we've had recently another swimmer, Adam Peaty, also incredibly successful, decide he was stepping away from the sport for a bit for mental health reasons. You know, he's burned out, and now he's back again and wants to get in the pool and win more medals. So, yeah, sometimes a break is a good thing. And one of our number will be heading to Thailand for a nice break to this winter to get over a very busy F1 season.
Absolutely. I'm conscious of that. I don't have the house to myself today, so I won't go into
details about the agenda. Yes.
About what that trip is for. But yes, very much looking forward to burning through most of my annual leave immediately. slogging my guts until Christmas next year.
Use it or lose it. That's what HR have said to us. Anyway, let's move swiftly on from company internal politics to elsewhere in GP racing this month. Roman Grosjean gets the long interview treatment. Oleg spoke to him in Brazil, I think. Fascinating for a lot of reasons, including the way he separates his own career into the, sort of the pre and post Drive to Survive eras, because a lot of people, include especially people who've recently come into F1 as fans, will be mainly familiar with sort of his latter years as a bit of a running joke at Haas with, you know, daft spins in Barcelona at turn three where he nearly took out half the field, his team boss setting the radio alive with vibigorative sing-song porniloquies, the fire in Bahrain, of course, dramatic images. So what I said to Oleg before we embarked on that was, let's sort of throw it back a little bit further to Roman's earlier times, where equally, you know, he did have well-documented mental struggles. He got brain coaching to sort out some of his issues with his approach and consistency. And he got that reputation for being a first lap nutcase, which he still thinks is quite unfair. So also how his career nearly sort of didn't get going because he was part of the Spygate fallout in 2009. So, I mean, what do we make of Romain Grosjean? He's sort of quite an enigma, very fast on his day. I remember in the latter half of 2013, he was about the only person keeping up with Sebastian Vettel in that Red Bull sort of versus Lotus, as it was known then, battle. And you know, he tells us that they had a KERS mapping issue all season and it could have been even closer.
Yeah, it's incredible. You know, I'm sure for some of the newer listeners and fans to even think about the fact that just a decade ago, Romain Grosjean was knocking in those podium finishes in the second part of the 2013 season and doing so very consistently. And, you know, I remember really thinking this, you know, finally we've got a French driver. You know, there'd been a little bit of a lack of French drivers coming through. And as someone who, you know, when I first got involved in Formula One, there were lots of, you know, top drivers from France. And it was just nice to see Romain come through. And he was a coming man. You know, he had won the European, the Formula 3 Euro Series. He had won in GP2 Asia. He'd won the GP2 Championship. He did something called AutoGP, won that championship. You know, he was a guy who was regarded as a winner. And there was a lot of excitement around him. And when you look at the results that he achieved with Lotus in those sort of first couple of seasons, 2012 and 13 with them, you know, a couple of second places and, you know, a load of podiums, you know, in a team that was kind of on shaky ground for you know, for financial reasons, it was, you know, the owners at the time weren't ideal. But the fact of the matter is that he was driving the wheels off the car and doing a really, really good job. I met him on a one-to-one basis not long after that. We had a meeting at his house in Beaconsfield, and I remember thinking, you know, what a super guy, you know, polite, gentlemanly, clearly had a steely determination, was massively focused on where what he wanted to do next, where he wanted to go. He wanted to get into a top team. He wanted to go the whole way. And I mean, as you mentioned, you know, then you've got the Haas era, and it just, his career began to wash away from underneath him. Some of it was self-inflicted. Some of it was due to the fact that he's with this new team that's operating to a completely different business model in terms of their capability and their fundamental ability to develop a competitive car, and a team that was in many ways still finding its own feet to begin with. And it became wrong place, wrong time. And again, going back to our earlier conversation about Max Verstappen and comparing him to the greats. So one thing that all the greats have in common is getting in the right car at the right time in the right place, you know, the right support around you, you know, everything just comes together and suddenly you have that trigger moment, you know, where your career just, you know, you get that initial victory and then they just start to build up, you know, you just keep getting the wins. And of course, that's never going to happen if you end up in, and this is no disrespect to Haas, but if you end up in a team that doesn't have the potential to win. And I think with really competitive drivers like Roman is, you know, and his mentality was that of being super competitive and focusing on winning. I think once they fundamentally realize that they're driving in a car for a team that doesn't have the ability to win, that begins to chip away at their confidence. And it sort of becomes an inexorable kind of downward spiral. And you see it time and again with drivers who, you know, when they're in a competitive car and they're out there winning, the mentality is in one place. And then suddenly they find themselves in a completely different scenario. Again, I mentioned Damon Hill, you know, going from Williams to Jordan and then through Arrows and then into Jordan. And that victory that Damon had for us in Belgium, you know, that was a kind of golden moment where he recaptured his winning capability in a team that had never won. That's why it was so special. And if you look at the current breed of driver and you think about, I mean, Valtteri Bottas, you know, going from Mercedes to, you know, you look at what's happened at Alfa Romeo with Sauber, and without, you know, breaking any confidences, you know, he knows he's driving for a team that doesn't have the capability to win. And that does have an impact on you. And how do you keep leaping out of bed with the same degree of confidence and motivation each day, knowing that the thing that you dreamt about, or indeed the thing that you experienced in the past, which was knocking in win after win, podium after podium, it's just not going to happen again. And that must, again, play havoc with your kind of mental focus.
Speaking of Alfa Romeo, Sauber, whatever you call them nowadays, the kick, as we must call the car, fantastic to see a car being named after a seminal In Excess album of the 1980s. can't we extend that all the way down the grid, you know, and here comes Lewis Hamilton in the Mercedes Slippery When Wet.
That would have to be a post-watershed name for the team, I think. but yes, I did look at the renaming of Alfa Romeo this week and just thinking the renaming of what is now the Sauber team. I thought Andrew Benson's post on X was quite amusing. He said we had a 10-minute meeting in the office to discuss how we would describe the team or what we would call it. And we quickly decided we'd just revert to type and call it Sauber from now on, which is so obviously going to happen. You do wonder why people waste any time overthinking the naming of a team.
Yes. Ain't that a kick in the eye, to quote Bauhaus? Sorry, Matt, I've
I was just say
a pointless musical reference.
Then never pointless. I was going to say, I hope when the marketing team were having that discussion with Kick and saying, if you give us an extra 10 quid, we'll make sure you're featured as the Kick C44 I hope they didn't sort of religiously stick by that, because I promise with Marcus Simmons as my sub in Autosport magazine, it will never be referred to as a kick C44, C45.
He'll kick that out.
Yes, they will not be getting bang for buck from that one. It's quite, almost offensive. Well, I was going to say actually on Grosjean, aside from it being I think this is where sort of Oleg excels, these one-to-ones. You can see sort of, you know, how the way the questions are or the interactions when Günther Steiner gate crashes the interview, that Oleg sort of just dry wit is so perfectly suited for these. But I was sort of reflecting a bit on Grosjean. You absolutely have some brilliant performances. You know, he talks a lot about Spa 2015, when, you know, the bailiffs were basically waiting for him to get out the car, but his podium and what it meant for the team. But I just, you know, not to blow smoke, and I know the good part of the podcast is sort of agreeable debate, but I could not agree more with what Mark says. You know, if you think to when Grosjean went to Haas, at the time, that was a plausible route to a Ferrari seat. Certainly how he saw it, how it was portrayed, that he would use that. And certainly his first two seasons, he really has the measure of Kevin Magnussen, a couple of podiums, you know, there was sixth place on the debut and whatnot. And then I think, as Mark says, you then realise where your stock is in F1, that the route to Ferrari is closed. And then from then on, apart from 2020, which is not meaningless, but the car was so bad, apart from then Magnussen takes a big step forward and consistently beats Grosjean in the championship. And Grosjean was still fast, but so inconsistent from then on. I think sort of, yeah, just to reiterate what Mark says, that his stock went in high, he was a fast driver, and I think at that point he was still telling himself, there's a route for me to get regular race wins here and represent Maranello. But it tailed off, and I think that so clearly reflected in his performances throughout the season.
Yeah, you do get into a space where someone like Max Verstappen, you look at his performances in the last season and he barely put a wheel wrong, and that is someone at the top of their game coming in with complete confidence in their own abilities and not doubting for a second and just being able to knock it out of the park week in, week out. Whereas once the seed of doubt creeps in, you could see that with Grosjean, that he was flailing and struggling, and you start to look almost hapless, don't you, when you get into that space where you're thinking, I have to not cock this up. As soon as you come into something thinking, I have to not cock this up, inevitably it will happen.
No, and I think that manifests itself in inside the garage in a team. You know, a team can start to sense how you are, and if they can sense frustration and disappointment and then uncertainty, and you know, you throw the car on the wall, or you have an unnecessary spin in a practice or a qualifying session, damage the floor, give the mechanics all extra work to do. You know, it's all a complete distraction from what everyone's trying to do. And it just becomes that downward spiral. And this is, again, you know, talking about Max and Red Bull this year, it was so, I mean, you used the word metronome-like, so metronome-like, was just like, they turn up, they have a process, they switch it on. It's almost like a piece of software. It just fires up, does its job, wins the race, you know, and then they go home again. And then the other side of it is Roman. He doesn't know if he switches the software on, whether it's going to, you know, crash, restart, reboot, not work. it's just so frustrating. And that frustration manifests itself in so many ways for racing drivers. It's one of the reasons that I feel that really good managers are underestimated, and good managers could be the manager, or the manager, or the good manager could be a key advisor. It could be just somebody that basically a foil that person can go and, you know, have a rant and a, you know, brain dump about what's happened at the weekend, but can then sit down with them and say, look, clear that out of your mind, refocus. You know, you have to lead the team through this. You know, the car is not competitive. You have to decide whether it's your side of the garage that leads the team forward, or whether you let the other side of the garage start to lead the team forward. You've got to do your job better than you've ever done it before, because, you know, this is where we're at. You're in the trenches fighting a battle. You know, it's not going to be easy to get out of this. And this is where the psychology of the sport is just so important. And I mean, again, with Max, you've got that. I mean, he gets a lot of bad press and many times for good reasons, but, you know, you've got that very strong father in Jos. You have his manager in Raymond Vermeulen. You know, Raymond is no one's fool. He's known the family, you know, for a very long time. They know exactly what they want to achieve. Max doesn't have a particularly cluttered life. He doesn't have lots of distractions. He certainly doesn't have financial concerns, hasn't had financial concerns ever, really, for obvious reasons. And all of that helps, you know, enormously. It just helps you to be completely focused on what you need to achieve. And I think, again, when I look at Roman, I think, did he have enough support around him? Did he have an infrastructure around him that enabled him to clear his mind and focus? And actually, I think the answer is he probably didn't. And then when the burden is on your shoulders, I mean, that's a huge amount for one person to take on. I mean, I personally was delighted that he not just survived F1 in the literal sense, survived that horrendous accident in Bahrain, but then did go on to have a degree of success in the United States and look very happy and trying to be a pilot and is able to enjoy every day with his wife and kids, and probably reflects quite often on the fact that that was nearly taken away from him. And that's what's the most important thing to him now.
Yeah. I mean, it's very pleasing to see sort of when someone's at that stage of their career and they're sort of happy, but then you press a few buttons and you see they're still a little bit frustrated about a few things and the way some elements have panned out. And even today, you can see those drivers who are kind of struggling in the moment, and you can tell that feeling is shared within the team. For instance, you know, when a driver who is struggling has a little mishap on track, it will often cut to the scene in the garage and you'll see the mechanic, there'll be like a shrug of shoulders, packing stuff away, the odd rolling of the eye. You see it a lot in Drive to Survive, of course, but then again, their editing's so cynical that you'll see someone pin it in the wall in Barcelona and it'll cut to someone rolling their eyes in the garage in Monza the previous season because that's the best eye rolling they've got. But yeah, it is funny which drivers have got the dressing room and which ones haven't.
And of course, in the old days, drivers would, and I'm talking about sort of pre-data days, so up until the late 1980s, drivers could come back to the garage and say, I had a bit of a problem with the car, you know, had a bit of an off. These days, before the drivers even hit the wall, the whole team can see exactly what they've just done wrong. And this is why you hear these drivers come on now feeling rather dejected and say, sorry, guys, you know, I've put it off the track again. And the team knows that the team has greater visibility over their performance than even they do. And the relentless nature of that inter-team battle where you're sitting looking at the data of yourself and your teammate, you know, two or three times a day, every weekend, now for up to 24 times a year. If you're not on top of your game, it doesn't bear thinking about the degree of pressure that people feel. So I think it's it was really interesting to read this interview. And Roman is – I hope that he doesn't in any way live the rest of his life thinking what might have been, because actually he achieved a great deal, and it just was a case of not in the right time, in the right place, in the right car.
You can get away with shunting in sports car racing still, or at least up until fairly recently. I think it was Steve Soper, I think, had a shunt in the BMW prototype or similar in the Sebring 12 hours in the late 90s. And Dave Price, the late Dave Price, got on the radio to him one point. He goes, Steve, there's been a big crash. And apparently the radio crackled into life. Dave, it was me. Sebring. Anyhow, back to Formula One. As usual, things happen, funnily enough, and they happen between the magazine going to press and arriving on the newsstands, because that's a period of about a week or so. And also, we're a teensy bit late recording this podcast this month, just a teensy bit, because, you know, people busy doing Christmas shopping and stuff. Oh, yeah, it was your fault. you had like work and stuff. Oh no, someone said something they shouldn't and published it. Anyway, we'll be coming to that in a minute. That kept you busy. The share transaction at Alpine announced earlier in 2023 has gone through. So Ryan Reynolds and company now own their chunk. Slightly quieter was the announcement that Davide Brivio will be leaving the team at the end of 2023. I just find this a completely bizarre scenario, and it says a lot. I don't know about you guys, says a lot about the way Alpine has been run these past few years, as basically kind of like Wolf Hall stroke Game of Thrones, but without the dragons and gratuitous nookie, in that you have this guy recruited to do a job, and then he's almost instantly sidelined by some ambitious executive and ends up running the young driver program when he should probably have been running the team. So, you know, Matt, you've been in and around the paddock for the past couple of years. What do you make of this scenario? He's been a little bit, to quote an obscure Queen album track, the Invisible Man.
Quite. I'd actually like to start by quoting verbatim from Oleg's piece, because Grosjean on there, he says a couple of sentences and they stood out immediately, and I thought, damn it, nothing has changed. But he's talking about that. I think it's a Spa podium in 2015. He talks about the team, which obviously is still Enstone. There are a lot of moving parts at the time. They lost the leadership. Some new people came in, but they didn't know what to do, and they were selling the team at the same time. So bar that last bit, it transposes directly. And I think Brivio was kept away from the limelight, but as I understand it, MotoGP team boss, canny operator, I think he liked the idea of coming to F1, and Alpine like the idea of signing him. They went ahead with it, but among that bewildering hierarchy, you think, you know, the churn with a Bitterball, Prost, Rossi, and now Otmar Szafnauer. But I think he came in, and basically ultimately after a year, they didn't really have a position for him, or certainly the previous regime did. And that's whether in terms of job remit, they didn't have a position, or they didn't want to work with him essentially. And that's not on Brivio's side. I believe that's more of a case of the existing sort of suite of suits, as I put in a previous feature, just yeah.
A great little bon mot. You can use it two or three years, people might have forgotten, and you can use it again. Yes. Recycle your own material. I do, yes, it enough quite. Myself.
But I think, and he was pushed aside into sort of that, you know, he was never at events. It wasn't the F1 dream he was sold, looking after the Alpine Driver Academy. And I think Brivio comes out of this, because of the churn at Alpine, I think Brivio comes out of this sort of looking slightly better off of the two parties. But it should be said that, you know, the Alpine Driver Academy did fall under his watch, and ultimately its prized asset, Oscar Piastri, is now plying his trade for McLaren. Whether you put that directly at his door, or more, you know, Otmar or Rossi upsetting everyone he came into contact with, I don't know, but certainly that should go against him. And you know, the understanding is that he'll go back to MotoGP, so it's being billed as a mutual parting of ways, and it depends how you look at it. So an odd analogy, but if I clean my room, I haven't lived with my parents for 10 years, if I clean the house, I will drag everything out the cupboards and turn it into a bomb site, and then start again and put it all away and have total control over everything rather than just wiping down the sides. And I wonder if that's what Alpine is going for, because it's had such a brain drain now where it's got interim everything because there are no people to hold all the positions. Like Julian Rouse is interim sporting director, but will now be taking on Alpine driver responsibilities since Alpine Academy driver responsibilities now that Brivio is going. And you think of, you know, you count, and in terms of advisors and senior personnel, I think Alpine have lost 13 people over the past sort of 4 or 5 years. And is that what Famine's doing? The interim team principal, vice president of motorsport, the interim team principal who, as of Abu Dhabi, hadn't started looking for a successor. That might be just because he likes doing a job. So if I don't look for anyone, then I can't be replaced. But that sort of seems to me the only sort of reasonable explanation, is that you get rid of everyone and you sort of dig out the rot, the cause of the problem. And if they are finally, for the millionth time, and at least Famine is now acknowledging that Vieri and Enstone don't get on seamlessly, maybe you do have to basically clean shop and start again, and Brivio is part of that. But certainly it seems to me like he was sold an F1 dream, and that never materialized for him. He was never given the responsibility that he was promised. So whether that's him gone for F1 forever, or as an Aston Villa fan, he'll do an Unai Emery, he'll go away for a few years and then come back and prove to everyone that he was wrong to be sort of ousted in the first chance, I don't know. But it just, you know, it's hard. With Alpine at the minute, it's just hard to take anything at face value, isn't it? Because it just underlines our narrative that, or not our narrative, but the interpretation or the impression that it's absolute disarray. And all that, to go back to that Grosjean quote, although he's talking in 2015 about the team being put up for sale, if despite the Ryan Reynolds, Rob McElhenney investment, whatever, if that was the headline next week, as we've discussed ad nauseum on this podcast, no one would be surprised.
The unfortunate thing is with the whole Alpine story, none of it comes as a surprise. It's all so terribly predictable because the issues just seem to be repeated and repeated and repeated, and you wonder why they being Renault, the owners, don't realize that the problem is not Enstone. The problem is them. You know, look in the mirror. Where is the issue? The issue is coming from the way in which Renault structure that organization, have structured it in the past, the way that the leadership has been appointed, roles and responsibilities given. Laurent Rossi, highly experienced, very academically well-qualified manager, lots of managerial experience in the world of business, complete novice when it comes to Formula One. Why does anybody, whether it's himself or anyone else, think that he is going to drop into that role and immediately be able to make the kind of gains and the difference that needs to be made? This is why experience is so important. It doesn't matter whether it's a driver, an engineer, a team principal. Do you know this industry inside out and what it is that makes a difference and how it works? And if the answer is you don't, you can't be learning on the job, because this is an incredibly competitive environment. It doesn't suffer fools gladly. And, you know, so I feel sorry for the fact that this has become a kind of a milling machine for people who've had their careers and reputations damaged, and a team that's not achieving the ultimate success that we'd like to achieve. It's that nearly team. I mean, I've talked about it. I've written about it many times in the column in the magazine. It's a team forever in transition. You know, if we talked about team names earlier on, it should be called the Transitional Alpine Team. You know, just forever in transition. So, and David Brivio, I mean, when he was appointed, I telephoned some friends who work in MotoGP, and they all said, oh, yeah, Luca Di Meo, chief executive of Renault, was at Fiat when they did the deal with Brivio at Yamaha 15 years ago. Fiat sponsored the Yamaha MotoGP team. So that's when they got to know each other. And that was in the midst of Yamaha success and Valentino Rossi. And so the two of them will have great memories of those days and were probably eager to recapture those in Formula One. Luca Di Meo saying, David, my Formula One team's not doing very well. Would you please go in and sort it out? But the problem is you ended up with these kind of dual roles and, you know, a fuzzy structure, you know, and you can't have that. You have got to have a clear, concise structure, roles and responsibilities, someone who's got their name on the desk, the buck stops with them, you know, and whether, you know, it's a Toto Wolff at Mercedes-Benz, or it's a Christian Horner at Red Bull, or it's a Frédéric Vasseur at Ferrari, you need that person who literally is leading the team. They have to have that leadership. It doesn't matter that a Formula One team is now a very large organization. They still need to have a team boss, a team leader with clear accountability to drive the success of the organization. Other thing that I'll say, and it actually leads back to your introduction to this topic, Cotters, is the fact that they have sold a chunk of equity. you know, the Ryan Reynolds deal is interesting, because when we think about Mercedes Formula One, Mercedes only own 33% of their Formula One team. And actually, if I were Renault, I'd be looking very closely at the Mercedes model. Because the one thing that Alpine does not need to be is it run as a subsidiary of a car company. It needs to be given complete autonomy, its own budget, its own leadership, its own structure, and just go off and do, and be allowed to go off and do the job in the way that Mercedes have allowed Toto Wolff to go off and do that job. Yes, of course, Toto and Niki Lauda were accountable, and that, you know, they had their board meetings in Stuttgart, and they would sit down and talk to Mercedes about what they needed to win. But then they went off with complete autonomy to go off and deliver that. And I think the, you know, for me, there's a step missing there with the structure at Renault and at Alpine, and you need to have that very clear sort of firewall between the Formula One team and the whole automotive business, so that the Formula One team can just get on and do the job that it needs to do, led by people who have vast experience of the sport and can just ask the shareholders, say, this is the money that we need for investment. This is what we need in order to make the steps that we need to make as a team going forward. And it's been very disappointing to just see this, the team stagnate, albeit stagnate in the midfield. I mean, they're not a shockingly bad Formula One team. They're still kind of in the B class, but if they have aspirations to actually win, which Luca de Meo says he wants, they're a long, long way from making that breakthrough.
Speaking of firewalls, a couple of weeks ago, basically the entire staff of Autosport magazine decided they were going to use their annual leave allocation and departed en masse, left poor Matt Q to mind the shop. What could possibly happen in this gulf after the season had finished? Nothing could surely happen. Well, let's don the asbestos gloves as we tackle the hottest of hot potatoes, the extreme cooling of relations between the FIA and F1. So Matt flying the good ship Autosport solo when this thing went off like a grenade, didn't it? The FIA suddenly at about 5 o'clock in the evening via the WhatsApp group for their media thing announcing that their compliance team was looking into a potential conflict of interest between an F1 team principal and a FOM employee. Those parties were not named in this communication. But then again, the FIA didn't have to, because those people had already been named in a magazine earlier, Toto Wolff and Susie Wolff. And less than 48 hours later, the case was dropped, but not before all the F1 teams had issued a coordinated denial, what we might call the Shaggy defence. It wasn't me. Yes. So that meant this podcast getting delayed, because poor old Matt Q had to tackle the ensuing conflagration solo. Let's try and unpick a little bit of that. I don't propose to speculate about who squealed to whom. Obviously, someone did. This whole affair illustrates the foolhardiness of making defamatory remarks you can't actually prove. So let's steer around that. What does it tell us about the wider state of relations between the governing body and the commercial rights holder? Because it used to be that, you know, Max Mosley was very much in Bernie Eccleston's pocket, and they worked together to keep the teams in a pincer movement and divide and rule. Nowadays, the competitors and the commercial rights holder are very much on the same page, unified in pursuit of lots more money rather than being divided by it as in the past. And now the FIA has become the pantomime villain, you know, forcing other teams on them to dilute that prize pot, saying you can't have your nose pierced, saying we're going to kick down your door and have zero notice factory inspections. So where do we think this fissure has developed?
Yeah, so just to ever so slightly correct the record, my colleagues were still around. You shouldn't feel sorry for me too much at this time of year, but for the Autosport magazine season review, we have to do like I write the paddock politics feature, sort of a 3,000 word wrap up, and actually it was looking quite dry. And then 24 hours before deadline, this this sort of bombshell drops and you think, well, this doesn't solve itself in a couple of days. So I was trying to push back on deadlines, and it was very kind of all the announcements to come on like beyond 5:30 when I'm trying to go for my evening walk to decompress and then think about dinner. So that was why it irked. But yeah, the relationship between F1 and the FIA is absolutely, it's fractious, but it did sort of have a cooling off period. So, you know, you've got the fallout from Abu Dhabi 2021, and then, you know, what was basically what was happening when Mohammed Ben Sulayem was getting exposure. So you think of F1's lawyers having to effectively write a cease and desist letter when he suggested that 20 billion value was inflated for F1, you know, talking about value and commercial matters fall strictly under the remit of Liberty Media, not the governing body, so hands off. And then you think of like the jewelry or the switching between race directors or the bad handling of track limits. You know, that was all sour in a relationship, but then there was a cooling off period. You know, on track and off track, the 2023 season was quite dull, and the cooling of relations between F1 and the FIA was part of that. And that started really after that cease and desist letter. MBS took a step back from the day-to-day management of F1, handed that more over to Nicholas Tombazis, single-seater FIA director. And he said, you know, that was outlined in his manifesto, said this has always been the plan. However, he was still at races, still had a public profile, and there was a suspicion that the president wasn't, he was still basically pulling the strings from afar. So, you know, we have it on fairly good authority because everyone is tarnished by the same brush. If you work for the FIA, you are tarnished with, you know, working for a dysfunctional organization. And a lot of people at the FIA aren't. So, you know, at times it can be about as watertight as a sieve. So we have on fairly good authority that it came from MBS to reopen the investigation into Lewis Hamilton crossing a live track in a Qatar Grand Prix after his turn one shunt and sort of calling him out as a, you know, we need to set a standard because you're a role model. You think also to the, without warning, updating the international sporting code so drivers could be fined €1 million. Whether anyone will be, who knows? But the fact that this was done without warning and there were no sort of parameters or guidelines, that upset people. And then bubbling away, but really sort of gathering momentum in the second half of the season was the 11th team. You know, if you go back to when applications were opened, there has never been a satisfactory justification for expanding the grid. You know, there are plenty of good reasons why F1 should adopt another team, but they have never been presented as like the motivating factor. And it basically, again, other people or people suspect it's almost a vanity thing. So this CEO and this CEO said, oh, we'll jump at the chance to enter F1. Well, prove it then. Here's your opportunity, prove it. And it's gone from there. And obviously, you know, this could all end in a nasty lawsuit because the FIA have promised certain things to Andretti. Andretti have fulfilled that criteria and FOM have never said we want another team. So whether they'll say no and it all collapses. So that has soured the relationship. But then you have this right at the tail end of the season. And it's, you know, it's certainly a word we've heard so much over the past 3 years that it's almost lost all meaning. It's unprecedented. But what a display of unity from the 9 teams to do a coordinated, identical statement. You know, we didn't basically grass up the wolves to the FIA. And that's where it's come from. The original report is that it was supposedly a complaints from active team bosses about certain things being raised in meetings that could only have been raised based on information that should have been confidential. And so none of those teams are making the complaints, then why has the FIA been motivated to strike up its, you know, compliance department to investigate the wolves? And then they've come back sort of 24 hours before their own prize giving gala and say, oh, whole issues dropped, everyone. Sorry about that. Whoops, guys. No, we're happy. We've seen all we've needed to. But A, you suspect that the timing was very deliberate right before or right on the eve of the ceremony, where I might add that the president was a lot more predictable than he was, you know, at other prize giving ceremonies when handed the microphone. But also, you know, there was no, basically when all the team bosses said, no, this is nothing to do with us, that piled a huge amount of pressure on the FIA to disclose exactly what had motivated them to. Basically, what is your source? And the statement they put out in response was unsatisfactory. And again, it comes back to people inside the FIA were furious about this handle. How daft do they look? But it's not everyone. It's not everyone. It's a certain few. And so it's a really messy, messy saga, but it has underlined just how close F1 and its teams are at the minute. You know, they're enjoying an embarrassment of riches. And so that naturally makes you sort of happy, happy bedfellows. And the FIA have tried to undermine that. And that relationship is so sour. You know, for the first time since 2009, there's proper talks about a breakaway, but rather than a breakaway championship, it would be breakaway governing body. Although that's very hard to do because then circuits need to be homologated to the new F1A or whatever they decide to call their potential breakaway. So that's very hard in theory, but the relations are so sour. And just because it's Christmas and everyone's getting merry on sherry does not mean that this won't be revisited. You know, of all the, you know, Toto Wolff is incredibly powerful in F1. All the nine teams releasing statements of F1 saying, we're surprised we weren't coordinated. By far and away, the most damning was Susie Wolff saying, this is rooted in, you know, misogyny and people bringing my personal life and my marriage into it. Her statements were by far the most damning. And the nine teams all in their second paragraph or their second sentence saying, we are 100% behind F1 Academy. In other words, Susie Wolff. That topic will not go away. It must be horrible to be at the storm of it, both the Wolves, both for the people sort of a couple of ranks down at the FIA, but to watch on from, it's like perversely, it's so fascinating. It's bonkers.
Couldn't agree more, Matt. Everything you've said, spot on. When I read the two FIA statements, the announcement of the investigation and then the fact that it was wrapped up within a couple of days, then to read Susie's two statements, as you say, this unanimous approach that all the Formula One teams took to get behind her to support Susie. I thought to myself, how unprofessional does the sports governing body look? That's the only word that can come to mind. How unprofessional. That their relationships with their Formula One teams and with the team principals of their Formula One teams and with the managing director of the Formula One Academy can be so poor. Their relationships amongst the individuals concerned can be so poor that they conduct this embarrassing episode via press statements which have no merit whatsoever. And it was an appalling sequence of events. And it's so disappointing. And it's so disappointing because, you know, you talk about the Max Mosley, Bernie Eccleston era. That was a very unhappy period for so many people in our sport. I'm a bit of a Bernie Eccleston fan, I have to admit. I think he did a great deal of good in building the business of Formula One. He didn't get everything right, not by a long way, and he didn't have views and opinions, which I agreed with. Not that that's of any particular value, whether I do or not. But, you know, overall, I felt Bernie did a very good job. Max, of course, on terms of safety, did a huge amount. But the politicking got bitter. It was nasty. There was so much that went on, which, you know, I felt was beneath them and beneath the sport. And we then went into this era of Jean Todt. And Jean Todt and Bernie weren't the best of buddies, but they got on okay. And they agreed, we need to just let each other get on with our job. And that's what they did. And we had this period of really quite long stability. And I think it's, you know, something that I haven't seen a lot of commentary around, but I think is very noticeable, is that in the wake of the Susie Wolff FIA debacle created by the FIA, you then have Jean Todt, the former president, giving an interview in L'Equipe, France's leading sports newspaper, last week, really, again, using that word, unprecedented, giving really an interview that I never thought Jean Todt would give, where he talks about, he basically counters the criticism that has been made of him by the current president of the FIA. And the fact that you have a current president and a past president, it clearly don't see eye to eye, and that the current president has kind of criticized his predecessor is, again, quite telling. So there's a feeling that we're now in a time where there are personality conflicts, there's a degree of bitterness, and it's then manifesting itself in some of these unprofessional moments. And exactly as you say, Matt, that is not the FIA as an organization. It's not the people who are employed to do the difficult job of administering the sport. And by far, most of the people who work in the FIA are doing a very hard job very well. Even more reason why the president needs to lead the FIA in a particular way and ensure that things are handled in a way which is transparent, is fair, is principled, and deals with stakeholders in a professional manner. And I am not surprised that Susie Wolf issued the statements. I think the ferocity of those statements takes some rereading. You know, those will not have been issued without her passing them by, I'm quite sure, a lawyer, you know, to say, is it okay if I say this? And she's on very strong ground. And I think instead of the FIA simply saying that the case had been wrapped up after a couple of days, it actually begs for a very fulsome public apology to her. And that hasn't happened. And I don't think that will happen because of the current leadership. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens next. Exactly as you say, Matt, it's fascinating for people on the outside. It's probably a bit terribly uncomfortable for people on the inside, starting with Toto and Susie Wolf, who in Toto Wolf, it goes without saying, was the one man who did not need the president to do yet another thing to annoy him. And it'll be interesting to see what the legal outcome of all of this is in the coming weeks and months, because I doubt very much that it's going to be forgotten about very quickly.
Beautifully put. I think we steered through that one very neatly, and it's not over yet. Thankfully, it's gone a little bit quiet now. I was actually quite pleased when the only hot news of this week was Guido van der Garde announcing his retirement. Lovely bloke. We had a great time in Tokyo doing a photo shoot with Caterham. It is. We've gone over the hour, so our new producer's going to be raging at us. Sorry, Torin. I had better wrap this one up and say thank you very much to our guests. Mark, you are released to have a glass of fine Barossa Valley produce.
I've got to go and write my column for you, which I'm late for.
Otherwise.
That's actually what I need to now go and do, is write a column. But anyway, thank you very much. It was a pleasure, as always.
Because otherwise, Wiggy will be on the first plane now and say, Jojo, where's your column? Matt has another couple of weeks to write his, so you can, have some sherry if you feel like it. Thank you for joining us today, now that the news heat has subsided a little.
Absolutely. I was discussing with my partner. We've lucky enough to move into our first home together this Christmas, or purchased our first home together this Christmas. But it's a horribly generic semi-detached with no fireplace. So we are wondering what to do with the carrot, sherry and mince pie. Will Rudolph on Father Christmas be able to get in? We're not sure.
On YouTube, you can get fake fires, can't you?
Yeah, there is a Netflix, I'm sure, available in other streaming services, but you can just watch a fireplace for an hour and a half if you feel so inclined.
Well, you cancelled Netflix. And as everyone hence in your house. Generation has done. Yeah, hence the house. Yeah. GP Racing Magazine requires your assistance. Buy the magazine. Keep us all in work. Go to gpracing.com to find out all the latest subscription offers. And of course, we can't say goodbye without saying a fabulous thanks for many years of fun and laughter and torment on his part for all the libels he's had to cut out. Our long-suffering producer, Martin Lees, leaving us for pastures new. Big welcome to our new producer, Torin Holland, the no doubt soon-to-be long-suffering Torin Holland. Welcome aboard, Torin. Now, if you're wondering where you can find GP Racing on the newsstands, you can go on the internet, go to our distributor, seymour.co.uk, to find their store finder. That is Seymour spelled as in Nick Seymour, the bass guitarist from the band Crowded House. Thank you very much.
Excellent.
We will see you next month. Have a fabulous Christmas and New Year.